today, it's my absolute privilege to bring to you today to sort of try to create a climate or to interact with you on this theme, freedom of expression, which is so controversial as you can imagine. And I'd like to first of all say that this is not a lecture. This is simply dialogue designed to provoke critical thinking and designed to provoke and stimulate our thinking and our capacity to be able to debate around the issue and not just settle for what's on the surface. So with that, as you can see, freedom of expression. Who determines the balance? And as you can imagine, last year and into this year, we've had some really interesting events that have sort of shaken the world as we know. We've had things like the Arab Spring, and we've had things like Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Malaysia, the Occupy movement, and that sort of thing. But one of the interesting things that stems from freedom of expression, I suppose, is the controversy around it. And freedom of expression is something that's not only offline, but it's also something that touches the periphery of virtually every social strata imaginable. And with that, I will be focusing on online freedom of expression and exploring some of the conflicts, the controversies, and sort of teasing out a few of the fundamental elements that we should consider when we're discussing things like freedom of expression. And most of you may know that as we speak, the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva are convening. And in fact, tomorrow there's going to be an expert panel that comprises of Frank LaRue, the special rapporteur, who wrote and published the report to the United Nations on this particular topic last year. And so they convene tomorrow, and there's an organization called APC that will be part of that panel. And I strongly urge all of you to try to stream in and to join the discussion. And today what I propose to do is to get us to dialogue around freedom of expression, but I will be coming from an ethical-based platform. So as you can see, with something like freedom of expression, there's a whole bunch of things to consider. You know, it's reasonable to say that there's a need to navigate through the maze. How do we determine the balance? You know, there are all sorts of things, there are all sorts of issues. Religious content, hate speech, lawful content, censorship, objectionable comment, filtering. The minute you talk about online freedom of expression, these thoughts come to mind, well, at least to my mind. And there's a tendency to be easily to be confused, I suppose. And again, I speak for myself, I'm not saying that people are confused, but I recognize that there's a tendency to be able to navigate through the maze, especially when it comes to something like freedom of expression. Next slide, please. Whilst I'm speaking, if you have any questions, just type it in. And as you can see, there are things like objectionable content what's virtually accepted in terms of objectionable content is things like child pornography, hate speech, defamation, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, advocacy of national, racial, religious hatred, incitement to discrimination, hostility, and violence. Next slide, please. And you see this happening all over the world. I thought about putting pictures of the Egyptian revolution and the Tunisian revolution, and then I thought, because everyone sort of seen it on TV, so you'll have a fair view and a fair appreciation of the levels of the revolt of the revolt to hunt down dissidents proactively, especially through Facebook and that sort of thing, through the social media. But it was interesting that today, you know, there's a report to say that things are escalating. And I'll ask Arvind to continue to the next slide. And it's not isolated to Iran. You also see things happening also in Syria. And in Tunisia, just this month, three newsmen from Tunisian printed newspaper, they were arrested for publishing a controversial picture of a Tunisian and Real Madrid soccer player, Sami Khedira, and a model, Lena Gurk, her naked photograph. Well, as you can see, I've put the picture up, but I've sort of put a little square box to sort of cover the girl. We'll get back to it later. Next slide, please. So these are sort of things that are happening around us, and this is just this month, by the way, February. And so you, and then even more interesting, we see even as recent as this month in Pakistan, there was a request for proposal issued by the government of Pakistan in relation to vendors to sort of bid or to put in their RFPs in relation to filtering mechanisms. And there's an organization in Pakistan called Bites for All, Shahzad, and he's done some pretty interesting advocacy, his organization. And so they came up with this article, locking up the cyberspace in Pakistan. Now, what's interesting about it is that here in Pakistan, there are two divergent views. On one hand, you have civil society in Pakistan saying, no, you shouldn't filter the internet. The internet should remain open and free. On the other hand, Pakistan Telecommunications Authority and along with government, they're on record, or at least they're reported to, according to sources from the web, to say that these are fully legitimate and they're legitimate basis for it in law in terms of things like things that are morally acceptable. So in other words, things that don't meet that criteria sort of get filtered. And interestingly too, in Pakistan, a few of you may be aware of it, they were also engaged in SMS filtering, and it was this that received quite interesting media attention. If we could move on, please. We welcome those who've just joined us. And in India, we see Vinay Rai's petition against giants, and it's sort of like a David and Goliath saga, where he issues a petition against Facebook and Google, telling them to block certain sites because as far as he's concerned, they're objectionable because they're bordering on obscene, in inverted commas, and one of the interesting features, one of the interesting aspects of this particular matter is that the Delhi court held and even said that, you know, that ISPs should be able to block websites that host objectionable content. If we could move on, please. And if you recall, the very second slide, I had sort of listed things that are categorized or generally accepted under international law to be objectionable. And interestingly, last year in the United Nations Human Rights Council, the special rapporteur, Frank LaRue, he came up with a three-part cumulative test. And this is what he said. As with offline content, when a restriction is imposed as an exceptional measure on online content, it must pass a three-part cumulative test. We go through this test to have at the back of our mind the objectionable content that we'd sort of seen earlier. And so this is what he says. Firstly, one, It must be provided by law, which is clear and accessible to everyone. And he says, and he inserts his comments to say these are principles of predictability and transparency. And on one view, things are relative. And of course, in human rights, there's a huge debate between universalism and cultural relativism. So who determines predictability and transparency? So in two, it must pursue one of the purposes set out in Article 19, Paragraph 3 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is to namely protect the rights and reputation of others. Two, to protect national security or public order or public health or morals, principles of legitimacy. And it's quite interesting if you see the Occupy Malaysia. When the Occupy Wall Street had a domino effect and it sort of spread like a virus all over the world, not saying that it's negative like a virus, but what I'm trying to say is it spread like wildfire. That's a better word, wildfire. It spread like wildfire across the face of the earth. And then government started rethinking their positions on levels of what sort of content is acceptable. So in terms of protecting national security, you'll see that quite a lot of them began to put out things like they've already had Public Order Act, but they put out regulations to sort of look into curb the hype. And I suppose in that essence, things like national security or public order. And of course, if you look at the third test, he goes on to say, it must be proven as necessary and the least restrictive means required to achieve the purported aim. And he goes on to comment, principles of necessity and proportionality. In addition, any legislation restricting the right to freedom and expression must be applied by a body which is independent of any political, commercial, or other unwarranted influences in a manner. So, on one hand, they're saying that, if there's a law that says, this content is objectionable, then that's fine. It's acceptable that you can filter that or you can block that. However, the third is saying that in order to ensure that the things are proportionate, that the legislations that are being issued or being promulgated or being enacted must be applied by a body which has no political or commercial interference. So that's a very interesting proviso. If we could just move on, please. If you see Frank LaRue's three-part cumulative test, he refers to Article 19 of the ICCPR. And this is what he says. What the ICCPR says. Everyone shall have the right to hold opinions without interference. In other words, you can say whatever you want. I'm reminded of a matter that happened in the 1960s, called Cohen versus State versus Cohen, and they were trying to draft him into the Vietnam War, and he was in the court corridor, and he had a jacket on, and in the jacket it said F the draft. Of course, it was a longer word than the F, but you know what I mean. And the short version of it, he was prosecuted, and and the state or the prosecution tried to say that, look, he's trying to incite rebellion or that sort of thing. Well, that's the connotation. But fortunately for Cohen, the courts in California and eventually in the U.S. held that he had a right to express himself, and that was protected and enshrined under the Constitution. But as you can see from Frank LaRue's three-part cumulative test, and even as you will see in Article 19 of the ICCPR, rights are not absolute, they have exceptions. So here in two it says, Everyone shall have the right of freedom of expression. It shall include freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing, or in print, in the form of art, or through any other media of his choice. And this includes, of course, the internet. And for those of you who've been following the famous Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, who's currently being hounded and prosecuted in China, he's an artist and well known for his work. And he's also controversial because he also has nudity in his art, and people in China feel that there are lots of views about Ai Weiwei, but some see him as a champion testing the boundaries of freedom of expression in China. Well, in 3, it goes on to say, the exercise of rights, and this is the exception, the test, provided for in paragraph 2 of this article, carries with it special duties and responsibilities. It may therefore be subject to certain restrictions. So note the use of may, and note the use of subject to. But these shall only be such as are provided by law. So in other words, again it's saying that unless it's provided by law, so this is where Frank LaRue's 3-part cumulative test is actually is actually drawing from. For respect, so provided by law, for respect of the rights or reputations of others, and things like defamation. So if you recall in slide 2, I'd sort of listed objectionable content, and one of them was defamation. Now the issue here is, what are instances in parts of the world where accountability and transparency is not present, but people would like to raise issues against or issues concerning accountability and transparency? So these are sorts of undercurrents that need to be explored, because as most of you will know, especially with things like defamation, it's generally accepted in some jurisdiction in the world that the truth is an absolute defense. But there are countries in the world where this is not so. And I think Frank LaRue, in his report last year, he did mention that there were instances, there were countries in the world where things were questionable, that there were no legitimate basis in law, that often some of the drafting, the draft provisos prohibiting certain content were so broad and ambiguous. And so it goes on to say, for the protection of national security or public order or public health or morale. And back to China. Well, there's a human rights activist in China called Hu Jia, and this is what she has to say as far as what freedom of expression means for her. She says, freedom of expression is the starting point of the rights of all citizens. It's the key to open democratization of China. And she goes on to say that protecting her freedom of speech is her civic responsibility. Safeguarding freedom of expression in society is her civic mission. Next, please, Avi. Can anyone tell me what this image is, or this diagram reminds them of? Anyone? You can type it into the chat room. Everyone saying is able to read all the chat. As you can see, I put smiling faces at the bottom here. By the way, I'm not artistic and I'm not artistically inclined, but I like to put things in pictures to be able to illustrate some of the basic things or some of the concepts. If you look at this one picture alone represents and symbolizes, can anyone guess? Put it into the chat. It actually illustrates family tree. Good try. Anyone else? It looks like a family tree. world, very good. Family tree world, excellent concept. James world, yes. Anyone else? Yeah, you could see the world and the tree, very good. Halima says world too, she can see the world. Hisham says, sees a map there, dictatorship, interrelated world, very good. Manuela, I like that, interrelated world, excellent. Anyone else? What do you see when you see this? Images are powerful. They have the capacity to convey messages in more ways than any text can. Caroline says tank. Interesting, yes, it looks like a tank. Like I said, I'm not artistic. Well, what you see before you is my half-baked attempt. And I think just dictatorship and top-down of freedom of expression, James. Oh, that's a good one. I'm a tank along the border. More, oh, that's even funny. Well, what you're actually witnessing is my attempt at conceptualizing a very important part of the ICCPR, which often gets forgotten, in my view. If you look at the smiling faces, they represent people. And one of the things that's woven, beautifully woven, I must say, into the ICCPR's preamble, and just to give a bit of explanation about preambles for those who may not have any legal background. Preambles are not enforceable, but they're usually drafted to convey the spirit and to convey the essence and the philosophy that's infused into the actual draft. So you can have constitutions, you can have preambles before the constitution. So in this case, the ICCPR has a preamble to sort of describe the philosophy and the essence within the actual covenant. And so you see humans down here, and it's said in the preamble that it's implied that there's an inherent dignity that every human possesses. And Stephanie raised a very important word when I asked you guys for feedback. She used the word family tree. Now if you take the word family, you know, human family. So equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family. And so there's an inherent dignity attached to that. So there's no such thing as, yes, whilst we're of different nationalities, yes, we have divergent languages, we have different tastes we have different cuisines. However, we're all part of this human family. And so the ICCPR gives voice to that. If you look at the preamble, it mentions that there's a level of equal and inalienable rights, which you can't take away, of all members of the human family. Not some, but for all. So it's sort of like, and that's the spirit and the context in which the preamble is being drafted. And then it goes on to say that this is the foundation for three things. If you read the preamble, and I would invite you, if you have a moment, to try and Google ICCPR and have a read of the preamble. The preamble itself is so beautiful. And it talks about how equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family are the foundation of freedom, peace, and justice. Beautiful. So when we begin to see this, then we begin to realize, we step back from the legal, framework, and we step back from the ICCPR, and just go back to the philosophy or the underpinning values that was in the mind of those who drafted the ICCPR, and then we begin to see that, you know, they were looking into the future, and they recognized that in order to build a society where humans were free to be able to freely express themselves, and that sort of thing, where there was social order, there's peace, there's justice, that for that to happen, that, you know, there has to be a foundation laid. So when reading the article 19 of ICCPR, I would strongly welcome or strongly urge that we also read the preamble in conjunction. Yes, thanks for putting that into the chat room, the link. If we could move on to the next slide, please. So the ultimate question is, and this is where the controversy lies, and there's so many heated battles going on all across the face of the earth, and in virtue, it doesn't matter what it doesn't matter what jurisdiction, the same question keeps coming up. Who determines the balance? Who determines the balance? And often you have various human rights, conflicting with each other. And the ultimate question is, who determines the balance? And the European Court of Justice, as recently as last year, they published a judgment, and I've included the link here, where it sort of says that European Union law precludes the imposition of any injunction by a national court which requires an ISP to install a filtering system with a view to preventing the illegal downloading of files. So you can assume, just from reading that, that someone who felt that their intellectual property rights was being violated because there were people illegally downloading files. So they filed an injunction in court, and filing an injunction is to try to stop to get the ISP to install filters so that people stop illegally downloading. And it was interesting to see what the court held. And judgment was released in November 2011, and I've given the link. And next slide, please, Arvind. And so the question that arose was this: in terms of prioritization of rights, I mean, the thing is, they're all rights, they're all human rights, but how do you know which ranks first? And what I would like to underscore here is each context is different, and every court, when the matter gets tested in a court of law, assuming that the court is independent, of course, we'll have to consider the context, you know, each context as it comes. But in this particular matter that I've just raised, the issues before the court was this: freedom to receive and impart information, based in terms of prioritization, not intellectual property rights, the rights of consumers to privacy, the right of ISP to conduct business freely. As you can imagine, having would mean that you would have IP addresses that were attached to identities of individuals, and so therein lies the issue of rights of consumers to privacy on one hand. And of course, here you have an entity or a company who feels that their intellectual property rights is being violated, and going to the court, an independent court, and saying that, look, we want an injunction. We feel we own intellectual property rights to this. We have all the relevant copyrights and patents, and therefore you should not allow. You should the ISP should filter. And then on the other hand, you have the ordinary user, like you and I. Well, I'm an ordinary user. And who just likes to receive and impart information. And so if we put receive and impart information in everyday speak, it's like, okay, to upload and to download. So I'd like to download this from this site, you know, that sort of thing. So even that is a right. And then on the other hand, you have the internet service provider, which the person or the company who feels that the intellectual property rights is being violated is going to the court to say the ISP should filter this. And on one hand, the ISP, as part of their economic rights, they have a right to conduct their business freely and without yes. And the issue for the ISP is, and again, this is where we get to look at all angles. The issue for the ISP is, okay, if I'm going to filter, it's going to cost me a lot to filter. It'll mean I'll have to install a filtering system. It'll mean more work, and it's possibly expensive, and that sort of thing. Yeah. And so you have this dichotomy. And of course, this was in Europe, and it was, I mean, judgment was delivered last year in 2011. But I would like you, at the same time, while we're discussing this situation in Europe, to I'd like to draw your attention to the slide that I'd showed you on the Pakistan filtering, the RFPs, and that sort of thing. So, different scenarios. So, next slide, please, Arvind. So you can see, if you watch the world trend, how generally the courts have tended to rule in different jurisdictions, you'll see the following. In the United States, they view protection of private ownership rights against privacy. In Europe, as you can see with the European Court of Justice, I think I'd showed you the link to the judgment. I would like to encourage you that if you have time, if you're interested, to have a look at paragraphs 52 and 53 of that particular judgment. And then you'll see that what the court held in terms of the prioritization of rights was that privacy trumps the rest of the other rights. And one of the things the court held in reference to the previous slide, with the matter that came up before the European Court of Justice, was that European Union law superseded national laws. And one of the key things that the courts had to consider was, the chance and the likelihood of lawful content being blocked. And so here you can see how they're thinking, if there is a chance, they're saying that yes, fine, if the content is objectionable, it's okay. I mean, it's legitimate in law to filter. However, if there is a likely chance that lawful content will be blocked, then privacy clearly trumps the rest. And then in the case of India, China, Pakistan, Iran, and even Fiji, you have public order, where often the state relies on the public order proviso under ICCPR or national security argument. And I can see from the chat transcripts, allow me to read it, in terms of things like terrorism, yes. Things like terrorism, that's related to national security. Under those circumstances, it's perceived under international law, at least under the ICCPR, as I've showed you the exception, where it's acceptable to actually filter. Again, I'm referring to online content. However, if you look at how the European Court of Justice, so that's objectionable content. But the issue that surfaces for discussion is, who determines the extension of that? Or how do you, what are the legitimate basis for determining the extension of that? Who decides what's objectionable? Is it limited to the things that I raised in slide 2? Or can it be abused? That sort of thing. Next slide, please, Arvind. Thank you, Arvind. Next slide, please. So the question is, who determines the balance? At the end of the day, and I draw your attention to, at the end of the day, think about societies. Societies decide, they are the barometer for social consciousness, in my view. Take, for example, in the United States, once upon a time, blacks were forbidden from using the same bathroom as white. And of course we know, as history has shown us over time, that social consciousness changed, where clearly that was perceived as ridiculous, and now you have a black man as a president, Barack Obama, His Excellency. And so who determines the balance? Who determines social consciousness? So what I would encourage us to set our minds to in terms of teasing out issues on freedom of expression is not to just blindly accept that just because the courts hold that this is, you know, is more important, that this right is more important than that right, doesn't mean that, I'm not saying that we disagree with it, but what I'm trying to say is that we should get our minds to dialoguing around the philosophies underpinning that, and to set our minds to that. And one of the critical issues, or the critical things that needs to be considered, especially in a season where so many controversies abound, is what are ethical-based platforms that we can set our minds to, and how can we build on this ethical-based platform. And if take the issue of Pakistan, they have issued an RFP for internet filtering. On one hand, you have people saying that you shouldn't filter. On the other hand, the government is saying you should, we're allowed to filter. And so these sorts of issues have to be teased out. What are the ethical-based platforms? And if you recall in one of the slides where I showed you the preamble, the fundamental building block of society for you to have freedom, peace, and that sort of thing is the assumption of the inherent dignity that's linked to the individual. We're all part of a human family. And so these are some thoughts. So if I could have some of your feedback or some of your questions, and the things that you'd like to disagree with, please feel free. One of the things that it mentions is that people must be able to freely participate, you know. It doesn't say that expressly, but if you look within the spirit of the preamble, connotations of, you know, people being able to participate. And one of the fundamental things about freedom of expression is it's critical. It's critical to having good governance. It's critical to having security and stability. Of course, there are exceptions to the rule in terms of incitement to create violence and that sort of thing. But with that ends my presentation, and I would like to open this time for feedback and dialogue. Okay, Carolina, we can also ask, in whose interest are these rights being waived? Yes, that's a very critical question, and excellent thoughts, Caroline. In whose interest? And she goes on to say, I think that there's a pretty strong consensus on filtering material like that. And James goes on to say this could be tricky, especially in developing economies and post-conflict fragile states that have regimes that want to perpetuate themselves. And of course, a good example is Congo. Take Congo, for example, with the conflict minerals and the issues in relation to that. Here you have a nation that's so rich, abundant in natural resources, and yet stark poor. To this day, even with things concerning the internet, they don't have an ICT policy, they don't have a broadband policy. I can say with much confidence that the information society in Congo are working very hard to try to develop their country, and the government is also trying to work very hard. But as you can see, with things, with the flagrant abuses that can easily occur within a nation, from lack of appropriate mechanisms to check and balance itself, the abuse of state resources or national resources, and just lack of structure and systems. And this is where the internet is so remarkable. I mean, quite aside from just being a network, it's no longer just a network of networks. It's no longer just a super highway. It's totally redefined life as we know it. Communication, comms, and so people in Congo are able to post up, to put online things that are actually happening on the ground. Even in Burma, when you see a report of people capturing things happening on the street and streaming it live so that the world can see what's actually happening. So freedom of expression is critical. So yes, people can put laws to try to stifle and stop certain content from being published, but at the end of the day, the question is, who determines the balance? And here we've seen the ICCPR, we've seen the test, we've seen how it says yes, there are exceptions in law, but we've also seen that yes, you can have the law, but what are the ethical principles? Does it fit within the spirit of the preamble and that sort of thing? Okay, and Caroline says reasons for national security can be slippery. How do we know that certain things are going to impact on national security? That's a critical question, and this comes down to in LaRue's report, he sort of mentioned the independent court. But if you look at the doctrine of separation of powers, it's critical. It's critical that at least you have an independent court or separation of powers to be able to check and balance certain things. But of course, there are jurisdictions in the world that don't have that, and right. James is also asking. He's not asking. He's saying all of this would be very useful in society. I apologize. I'm having trouble reading my transcript. Useful in societies, basic rights issues, but countries where literacy rate could be low as less than 10%. Okay. So he's sort of implying from his comment, and you can all read it. He's sort of implying from his comment, tell me James if I'm wrong in interpreting your comment, that the reality is only a few people, there are countries in the world where there are only a few people who are privy to understanding rights or understanding issues or understanding freedom of expression. And this is why I suppose you have all kinds of organizations that exist to bring outreach. And to bring outreach and to build capacity around the world, especially and there are countries in the world whose main concern is drinking water or having electricity and that sort of thing, and you may say, oh, what online freedom of expression got to do with them? But that wasn't the focus of what I was trying to bring. What I was trying to bring to us today is to look at the test or the cumulative test, to have an appreciation for the diversity, which I'm sure we already all do, and to see how we can actually apply it, and to see how it has been applied in different jurisdictions, but to critique and constructively tease out the various issues. And a critical feature that I didn't really get to touch much on, but that I would really like us to consider and to go back and muse and mull over is, in the event that an ISP were to an ISP installs filtering mechanisms, which most of them already do anyway, in order to manage content. who determined, and this is a critical issue, who determined the transparency, or who determines, or how do you know that, you know, the filtering mechanism that's in place does not only filter, but it's restricted to filtering objectionable content. I suppose off the top of my head, I would assume, and again this is me assuming, I would assume that it would be the regulators who would ensure that the filtering mechanism is transparent. But then the question is, the regulator is only empowered by the legislation or the statute that empowers it. So remember when I asked the question, who determines the balance? And I alluded to social consciousness. So at the end of the day, it's consumers like you and me, consumers, ordinary people, who must have a say, who should have a say in understanding what sort of filtering mechanisms do the ISPs in my country have, and how can you intelligently advocate for an open and free internet. And the thing is, people are divided on the issue. Some people say that you shouldn't filter at all. Some people say that you should filter. Some people say you should partially filter. But as you can see from the ICCPR, there are things in international law or under the ICCPR that expressly state can be filtered. But the issue is, what type of filtering mechanisms? And I note James' comment. He said that the ISOC and, oh sorry, Hisham's comment in relation to ISOC and the technical community is trying hard to prove the technical problems with filtering, but obviously there are others who are working in opposite directions. So these are things that, you know, we don't have immediate answers to, but it's something that we can continue to dialogue on. And James is saying, is there any way that these super democracies could help developing democracies to be considered in approaching FOE? For example, he says, oh dear, my country. For example, there's a big drive in West Africa for governments to adopting the, and it's broken off, couldn't see it. So I haven't seen the rest of what James said, but in essence, he's talking about partnerships, cross collaboration between developed democracies and emerging democracies. In all honesty, James, my personal opinion is 2011. If anything, 2011 and 2012, what it's shown us is it doesn't matter whether you're the U.S. or whether you're China, whether you're Pakistan, whether you're Iran, whether you're India, or whether you're Fiji. The trends that we're witnessing is never before in the history of the internet has there been such extreme controversy surrounding freedom of expression. And even for some of these developed democracies, you see things like the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is, by the way, being advocated within, you know, they were using legitimate channels, which is through Congress to debate it, in order to stop online piracy, that is the illegal downloads and whatnot. And so, on one hand, you see people expressly doing this, you know, transparently, upfront. And then on the other hand, you have instances like in Iran and in China, where you have it's done in the shadows. And so I think the issue of developed democracy and the issue of emerging democracies or those who have yet to be democratic becomes a non-issue. I mean, it becomes neutralized. I think what's being underscored here, is, at the end of the day, is it doesn't matter which country, but what is the acceptable test. And that's why I was sort of highlighting the ICCPR, the three-part cumulative test that LaRue raised in his report, and also, more importantly, the preamble. I'm just trying to read the rest of the transcript. I wish I could hear you guys. In talking about filtering, we're discussing before it's disseminated. What about removing... Let me see if I can read. Okay. What about removing... Oh dear. I'm wondering if there's a way to sort of expand my chapter. What about removing info that has already been disseminated? There have been instances, and this is accepted all across, well, at least in the part of the world that I'm from, in Oceania, where, you know, the matter is published, but the irony is the internet doesn't forget, where the matter is already published, and then there's a notice served for the information to be removed. And often this is the case with the media when they issue press releases, and then they get served with notices, and they remove it. So yes, that happened. But the thing about the internet is it doesn't forget. And why I say that is because even if the original publisher has removed it or has amended it or has revised it, at the time when it was live, someone else, third party, fourth party, could have copied it and pasted it and tweeted it. So that's where the issue of the internet not forgetting factors in. How do we remove it? That's something I have no answers to, and I have absolutely no answers to that. Okay, Maureen, in the Pacific, where the internet is in its infancy, sometimes it isn't governments we need to worry about with regards to lobbying against individual freedoms, but community or church leaders within specific countries where religious beliefs are strong. And that was Maureen's comment. When she says that, one of the countries that that immediately comes to mind is the country of Samoa, where religion is everything to them, and they say that that the pastors hold more force within social consciousness than political leaders. So again, it's going back to the issue of social consciousness. And so you have James Vincent, and he's saying freedom of information bill, even though it's tied down to some financial and logistical benefits, it does not give citizens the leverage to defend themselves if the government try to squeeze them. And this is very fundamental. Thank you, James, for raising that. That's something I'd like to underscore. At the end of the day, in terms of even if you think about the social contract theory, when individuals give up their rights to the state to be governed, they expect it to be done in a responsible way. In return, there's a level of reciprocity. So if you see in LaRue's report, and if you see in the ICCPR, it talks about things like proportionality. How far? And again, the thing is, you need to have an independent judiciary to enable people to bring their message, to get it heard. And that's where the separation of powers is a critical factor. But quite aside from the legal machinery and moving away from the rhetoric and the laws and whatnot, back to social consciousness. At the end of the day, it's society that determines, that is a barometer of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Because if you go back to time when they first put up the Obscene Publications Act. The Obscene Publications Act, and most countries usually have a version of the Obscene Publications Act. For them to be able to put up the act, it would mean that there was a level of social consciousness that rejected obscene publication, and to the level that they actually defined it. And so if you notice the second slide in this PowerPoint presentation, I've sort of listed what's been identified generally universally as objectionable content. And the critical issue is the ability to be able to discern and to distinguish between what's objectionable and what's not. And yes, very good. Yeah, I think it's a slide straight up to this. Yes, thank you for bringing that up, Arvin. Child pornography, hate speech, defamation, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, advocacy of national and religious hatred, incitement to discrimination, hostility, and violence. And Manuela is saying, I'm trying to read Manuela's comment. In Malaysia, for non-governmental domestic needs, people have to pay. Also, Caroline is asking, do you think that national emergency allows government? Oh, yeah, that went too fast. Allows government to limit freedom of expression, or should we uphold rights more in such times? Does this include encouragement of terrorism? And this is a very important question that you raise. And in fact, in constitutional law, there's only one instance where it's acceptable for a lot of the rights to be curbed. And it's only when the doctrine of necessity is invoked, and it specifically states that, generally most constitutions, that in a state of emergency on national security, and the discretion usually is given to the executive power, in some countries it's the president, to assess and discern whether there is a state of emergency, so that they can actually invoke a certain mechanisms which make it legitimate to curb certain certain freedoms, things like freedom of expression, things like freedom of movement. And having said that, again, it goes back to issues of the rule of law, where you have a clear separation of powers, there are more chances of transparency, there's a greater likelihood of transparency, where the executive makes that assessment independently. However, when this is not so, there's also room for it to be abused and that sort of thing. So that's in answer to Caroline's question. Yes, and comment. And again, I would like to say thank you very much, everyone, for turning up for this. This webinar on freedom of expression, and I hope that we will continue this dialogue and sort of tease out some of these issues, and maybe in whatever little way that this could have added to your basket, I hope that it would have sort of encouraged us to sort of relook and to scrutinize, and not to accept things at face value, but to take it apart and reconstruct. And so with that, it is my absolute privilege and pleasure to be able to talk to you on freedom of expression today. And again, I would like to remind you that there is an expert panel on freedom of expression that's going to happen tomorrow. And the expert panel will comprise of the OHCHR, I think. I hope I got my acronyms right. I often have trouble with acronyms. And the APC, and also the Special Rapporteur, Frank LaRue. And with that, thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank Diplo for the opportunity and for the invitation to speak to you. Again, thank you. So hugs from Fiji, and if you're ever in Fiji, feel free to look me up. Take care.